Welcome into this Five Clubs conversation. I'm Gary Williams. Our Masters previews. Today, we focus on design. Augusta National Golf Club, when it was created by Dr. Alistair McKenzie and Bob Jones, people are going, my gosh, what is this going to be? Well, somebody who knows what Alistair McKenzie intended to do there, but really wanted to do on all of his designs. Of course, Five Clubs contributor Gil Hance, his thoughts coming up right now on the design of the golf course, the things that stand up even today, almost 100 years later, all that on our design preview special of the Masters right now. Golf Pride has done it again. The brand new Golf Pride reverse tapered putter grips are the best I've ever used. And I didn't just get it. I've had it for months. And they have three to choose from. The round, the pistol, and the flat. The reverse taper putter design has a slim upper hand and a larger lower hand. I have never, and I promise you, never made as many putts as I had since I made this switch. You need to get the Golf Pride reverse taper putter grip today. And with that, we welcome him in from his office. His office is mobile. Gil, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, Gary. Yeah, it definitely is mobile. It's stationary right now, but it was mobile about 5 minutes ago.
Seriously, is there any place that you are more comfortable?
No. Well, I mean, yeah, around family.
I'm talking about work environment. Work. Is that your favorite place?
100%. There's no doubt about it. The solidarity, just being in here by yourself, listening to music, shaping, creating, it's a special place.
All right. You know, we did this last year with you to get your thoughts on Augusta National. I think for people who haven't seen that show, they should watch it. And we're not revisiting the same things, but to get you to talk about somebody who, among a handful of people, really kind of set the course for design of golf courses in this country, and that is Alistair McKenzie. Do you remember the first time you went to Augusta National?
Yes. It was the year Ian Woosnam won. Can't remember.
1991.
There you go. Yep.
That's the first year I was there.
Oh, really?
Yes.
We share that in common.
Yes. Wow. Now, do you remember, did you go with friends?
Yeah, I went with a really good friend of mine, Gary Jaeger, we went to high school together, and his parents lived in Aiken. So we were down there visiting them and him, and we went out, and it was great. I still actually have a photo of the two of us in front of the big Masters scoreboard. It's in my office. So it was a special day.
That is cool. So you were just there one day?
Just there that one day. Okay. Yeah, I think it was Thursday.
Okay. So were there things that you intended to see, that you wanted to see in particular? And if not, what about the golf course kind of struck you that day?
I mean, the beauty of it, obviously. And, you know, it's trite now. Everybody says the elevation change, right? But, you know, that was obviously incredible. You know, I didn't understand fully how the elevation, especially from the clubhouse down into Amen Corner, how significant that elevation change was. But I think, you know, as an architecture geek, 14 Green was one of the things that I wanted to go and spend some time standing, looking at. But really, you know, just being there for a day, it was just taking it all in. It was, you know, my heart of hearts, I'm still a golf fan. I'm an architecture nerd first and foremost, but I love the game of golf. And people say, oh, do you go to the Masters, you know, to hobnob or socialize? Where I'm like, actually, no, I go as a fan, right? Because we haven't had anything to do with the golf course. So it's not like I'm there studying or looking at anything, any of our work, like, you know, we're fortunate to do at some of the other major championships. So it's really just, hey, I want to watch these guys play golf, and I want to see it on the grandest stage that the game has. So I think that was really the, you know, being there with Gary was a lot of fun, and just, we just took in as much golf as we could, but not primarily focusing on architecture, more the scale of the place.
You know, Gil, you mentioned about these places that you've been entrusted to restore to varying degrees. Many of them have hosted major championships recently, many more still to come in the years right in front of us. And when you think about the people responsible originally, Donald Ross, George Thomas, Perry Maxwell, A.W. Tillinghast, Seth Rayner, CB McDonald, William Flynn. You've done work on all of their golf courses. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think until you did Lake Merced you had done a McKenzie golf course. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. Yeah, that was our
So what you're look, you you an, yeah.
Yeah, there's an asterisk on that. It was a McKenzie redo, not an original McKenzie, right. But we went back to what he did when he came and redid the golf course.
Okay. So look, you try to understand as best you can about what the original intent was, and obviously it wasn't original there. What were the things that struck you about the work that he did at Lake Merced that tickled you, that you loved, that you were enthralled by?
I think the biggest change for us as a team was the bunkering, right? The bunkering that he created at Lake Merced and in Cyprus, Paso Tiempo, just the beauty of it, the complexity of the shapes and the forms and the connection and the third dimension between the edges and the sand. And one of the things that, you know, we Jim and I have learned a lot through the years, primarily about bunker building, is from Bill Kittleman, the old pro at Marion. And so Marion usually informs the way we look at shaping bunkers, right? That big curvature in the sand, the white faces of Marion, sort of thinner tops, but the base of meaning the sand and the base of the bunker being really sturdy and a big upsweep, almost like the base of a wave, and then the crest of the wave being the top edge of it. And when we studied McKenzie, it was much flatter in the sand. Like the bunker is almost just kind of laid at grade. They didn't have that big curve or cup in the face. And so we were about a hole or two into it, and Seamus Maley ran the project for us out there and was doing most of the bunker shaping. And, you know, he's obviously used to working with us for years and years, and just kept saying, no, that's not right. That's not right. And it was like we had to relearn in our brain how to shape the floor of a bunker to match much more of what McKenzie had shaped out there. So that was really an interesting learning exercise. And then once we kind of hit our stride, I feel like we did a really good job representing his work. But the simplicity of what he did, like he took a golf course that was built by Willie Locke, had over 300 bunkers, and he cut it down, you know, down to well under 100. But they left an exclamation point in the landscape. Every one of them had a purpose, whether it was visual, whether it was strategic. And I think studying and learning that simplicity, and you hear a lot about that, you know, he and Bobby Jones at Augusta National, you know, very few bunkers when it was first built. It was really more about landforms and simplicity and the landscape instead of overwhelming the landscape. So I think looking at how sparingly he used bunkers when he transitioned a golf course that was referred to as the Pine Valley of the West to what he created in the late 20s at Lake Merced, it was a great learning exercise in restraint, yet still capturing the high points. Like the, you know, the 13th hole, the par three in the corner that, you know, we've talked an awful lot about, just how he almost like used everything on that hole and then kind of went back to a much more restrained presentation. And I think that was an amazing lesson for us, because I've always respected McKenzie more than any of the other architects, because I think he seemed to be the first to really understand the connection between strategy, interest, quirk to a certain degree, and beauty. Like he created beautiful golf courses and they functioned beautifully from a strategic standpoint. Some of the other architects, you know, as they matured, they started to create more beautiful compositions, but McKenzie just from like the start, you know, and they talk a lot about his background in camouflage and understanding how to set features in the ground and disguise them as to appear natural. And I think that's one of the big lessons we learned at Lake Merced, was that not only did he talk that, but he did it. And it was great from our perspective.
The and those types of bunkers, to me anyway, the application of that, what you've done at the park, what you've done at Ohoopee, what you've done at Caprock Ranch, what you've done at Stream Song Black, that kind of that natural transition from the proper bunker to the natural areas, to the vegetation. Like, that to me is some of the best stuff that you've done. Because there is it, there's a fraying, there's something about it that it's just like, my God, this, okay, I want to think that this was always here, but it wasn't always here. But isn't that like the greatest objective, to make people's belief being suspended, to think there's no way they did this because it looks like it's always been here?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the highest compliments we can ever get. And, you know, that again is a testament to all the guys that work with us, all the cavemen and their talents and their abilities to shape creatively and well. But I think it comes again back to Bill Kittleman. You know, the conversations that Bill and Jim and I have had over the years about that fraying, you know, the talking about the, I've used this analogy, or Bill's, you know, started with the tapestry, right? That the core of these great old tapestries, that everything's, the fibers and the weaving is really tight and the colors are vibrant. But, you know, over centuries, as you get to the edges, they fray and fade. And then, and so that's a golf course, right? A golf course should be tight in the presentation through the center. But then as you get out to the edges, it frays and it merges back in with nature. And I think the bunkering can be that perfect transition, right? Because you've got maintained edge, then you've got sand, and then you're going right into the native. So it allows you, both from an elevation standpoint, to tie back into a natural landform by using, you know, because you can make them steeper. So if you've got a steep slope, you can transition quite easily using sand, but it also provides that buffer between the green grass and the native stuff. If you went green, maintained turf right into bushes and shrubs, that's a very harsh transition. So you need to have sort of these layers of transitions. And I think McKenzie did that so incredibly well at all of his golf courses. Now, obviously at Augusta National, there's very clean lines, which, you know, are not really indicative of what he and Bobby Jones did originally. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's evolved to this point in time. And I'm not saying anyone would ever want to suggest that they change it. It's so iconic and it's so beautiful in its presentation. But when you look at the more raw examples of what McKenzie did, Cypress Point, Pasatiempo, Royal Melbourne, you know, you start to see that more natural transition and fraying at the edges.
The I've never asked you this. Have you ever been to All Woodley or Moortown?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What, explain to people, that was his first foray into, you know, taking thoughts in his mind and applying it to work on the ground. All Woodley, and then it was Moortown started with one hole?
I believe that's correct. So I think All Woodley was where he met Harry Colt. Colt was engaged. He was a secretary at Sunningdale and, you know, active in golf architecture. And he came to All Woodley where McKenzie was a member. Those of you in the McKenzie Society, if I've got this wrong, I apologize, but I think it's pretty close to being right. And so he started, he was almost like Colt's guy on the ground, very much like what George Thomas did for Fowler at LACC, kind of the guy who was there locally and who could be in charge and sort of oversee and implement. And I believe that Colt was just so impressed with McKenzie, had all these models of bunkers and everything, you know, kind of overwhelmed Colt with all this, with his enthusiasm for it. And then not far away was Moortown, which is where he did start out. I'm not sure if he started with the reef hole there. Or sorry, not the reef hole.
I thought it was like what is now, I think, the 10th hole, the Gibraltar hole.
So I think it's one of those things where then he transitioned to a little bit more of a forward role. And Moortown was very much more involved with what was going on there. And then ultimately formed a partnership with Colt and Allison. And so for, I think, probably about an 8 or 10 year period, they worked together until McKenzie left and, you know, came to the States to set up shop.
What you know, you mentioned Cypress Point and Pasatiempo, and to a large degree, what Bob Jones saw at Cypress Point, he was captured by it, which then created the momentum for the relationship for Augusta National. And here's the interesting thing about McKenzie, among all those players, and it was to varying degrees, but the point is, many of those Golden Age architects were really fine players, really fine players. He was not. What was the benefit of the collaboration with Jones above and beyond the, you know, the idea of getting people interested in it, because he was a truly a rock star? He was his biggest star in this country, sports and culturally, as really anybody. Beyond that, though, what was the biggest benefit to those two minds collaborating?
I mean, it's just conjecture on my part, but you know, a lot of really accomplished golfers see the game through their own eyes, right? The way they play the game, right? And but they have a difficult time visualizing landforms and how you could translate that into the ground until there's something shaped or roughed out in front of them. Then they have something to react to. As they're just walking through, you know, in that case, a nursery, it would have been difficult. And you know, Bobby Jones was exceptional in many ways. Maybe he was exceptional in the fact that he could actually visualize stuff in the raw ground. But I think the combination of the two, the great mind, the creativity of McKenzie, and his ability to get into, you know, blending the built with the natural and understanding those aspects of it, and Jones with the mind and the strategic aspect of what creates great golf, in his opinion. And then the fact that the two of them were perfectly aligned in their love for the old course, St. Andrews. So you walk around a property, you've got a guy who can visualize things in the raw, you've got a guy who can articulate at the highest level and play at the highest level what challenges and excites him. And so you would think that the merging of those minds would create something spectacular, which they did.
Yeah, I'll never forget the first time I asked you the question of where your greatest inspiration could come if I put you on the first tee anywhere and you just walked. We were sitting in the clubhouse at Stream Song before you were getting ready to embark on the Black Project. And you said, of course it's the old course. I mean, it's just, and they were the same way. And it has been pointed out constantly and repeatedly for generations that Augusta National, the inspiration did come from the old course. Today, what about it? Because again, the presentation is so different, but what at its core do you think is still true to what they intended to possibly take from there and apply it in Augusta, Georgia?
Well, I think it's the options, it's the angles, it's the ability. You know, we've had this conversation before about the best golf architecture means that the ability to play a golf course, you know, the level of precision, just to literally go out and play, is fairly low, right? If you can just hit it here, hit it there, knock it around and find it and hit it again. But the level of precision required to score is high. And that's the old course, particularly if the wind is blowing. And it's Augusta without a doubt. I mean, we see that every April, you know, with the hole locations they select and the green speeds and the angles and the, you know, wide fairways, but you really need to be on the proper side of the fairway to attack, and the slopes and all of the things that combine to make you literally have to hit very, very precise golf shots to score out there. Same thing in St. Andrews. And again, the wind always has to be a present, right? Given the way the game is played now, if the wind's not blowing, St. Andrews doesn't have as high a degree of precision required, but the wind should and usually is a constant factor. And that, you know, amps the level of precision required up higher. So I think from that standpoint, when you combine those elements, that's really at the core of Augusta National. It's more of a philosophical presentation as opposed to mimicking or copying. You know, it's not like they went out and built template holes. They just, at its core, those principles permeate all the way through the old course and they permeate all the way through Augusta National. And I'm certain that they talked about different shots and different ways to play and the green complexes. You know, one of the beautiful things about Augusta National is that the land, you know, with the exception of some of the mounding on hole number 8 and some of the mounds that you find around the golf course, is beautifully presented and it's so natural. And then you get to these green complexes and they are complicated. And, you know, if you really look closely, they are somewhat detached from the landforms, yet they're so well blended. And, you know, you look at some of the, like, sides of number one green, right? If you were to say, okay, trace a line from the natural landscape on both sides of it, there's a lot going on in between there. But then you look at 14, which is one of the greatest creations ever put together, and you look at how it blends in so beautifully on the left-hand side. But the right-hand side is bolstered by this huge mound, and because the scale of that mound is such that it lends itself to feel natural. So there again, I know Maxwell shaped that green, but you know, his teachings from the standpoint of McKenzie, it's that feeling of how do we blend and merge things together. So they kept the vast majority of the property natural. And when they had to create features, they did so in a way that they blend, but not perfectly, but that may have been more the focus on strategy and precision. It's like, okay, in order for us to create these whole locations that are going to be difficult to get at, we have to actually go ahead and move and create landforms.
You mentioned Maxwell. So Perry Maxwell had, you know, he did work with McKenzie, Crystal Downs, University of Michigan Golf Course. He was prominent in both of those projects to begin with. His work at Augusta National wasn't long after it was opened that McKenzie, you know, of course, he was gone immediately. But you mentioned 14. Take us through 7 green and the changes made to 10, because that green originally butted up against the McKenzie bunker, and how dramatic and significant the change to move it to where it currently is now. Just the Maxwell influence on Augusta National.
Well, I think one of the, you know, obviously the sad thing is that McKenzie passed and he wasn't involved in this, but, you know, almost without exception, almost every golf course goes through a period of study and ultimately, you know, reviews that say, hey, did we miss something here? Can we do something better? And having Bobby Jones there as a constant presence for decades allowed them to have a tie to the origins of the golf course, so that any time, like in the 50s, when Trent Jones came in and made some alterations there was always one constant, and it was Bobby Jones. So from the standpoint of, obviously we don't know how that decision was made to revisit, you know, 14, 7, 10, how did that happen, but the fact that he had this, you know, the foresight to say, all right, we're going to go and work, get somebody who worked with McKenzie, who understood McKenzie, who understood the what he might have ultimately created. And then obviously still having the presence of Jones there, they made some changes which improved the golf course, right? It was one of those things where 10, I don't think anyone can argue that that's a better green, you know, a worse green site than what they had down below just beyond the bunker. I think the fact that they decided to keep the bunker in the middle of the fairway was really interesting. They would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to say, you know, okay, we're going to move the green, but we're still going to keep that bunker. You know, why? What was the thought process behind that? Obviously 7 being a much shorter hole back then, you know, a greens within a green, like the little bowl down there on the right. And so, yeah, the right-hand side, the different hole locations, the shelf in the middle, just the level of precision, which we talked about earlier, maybe no other green on the golf course has that, in the different compartments. And then you get 14 in the scale and the scope and the, dare I say, audacity of that green. And, you know, we talk about waves, you know, the front of that green just is marvelous in its composition, that false front, the way it goes up onto the plateau. And then you've got the different hole locations, which we've all come to know so well over the years. So I think the creativity shown, well, 10 green isn't the most creative, it could possibly be the most frightening. You know, you hear them talk about being above the pin, being below, you know, all those sorts of things. The green, the location is amazing, but the green itself, and it could have very well been one of those things where, and I think these architects understood this perfectly, is either the shot requirements or just, listen, the setting is so spectacular up here on this ridge, we don't need to overdo this one. We don't, you know, it just can sit up here perfectly because the green site is wonderful in and of itself. So we don't need to go in and create a green that's got all kinds of drama in it itself. So I think combination of those things, obviously, you know, an incredible lasting presence at Augusta National as far as Perry Maxwell is concerned.
You know, the McKenzie bunker to me, Gil, is it's the edges are sharp and they're clean. But to me, that's kind of like the homage to him, because if you look at it from the sky, it's not homogeneous. It's the closest thing to what, you know, his imagination was when it came to that type of design features. So again, so the edges are sharp and they're clean. I think it's one of the most spectacular features anywhere in the world, especially if you're standing at the top of the hill on 10. Honestly, I can stand there and I can look at it, not for you know, an hour, but I could suspend myself there for a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and then scale wise, it has a great presence, and it's interesting because it sort of serves as the transition into flattish ground. Like, you've got this big hill coming down, and then you've got the climb up to the green, and almost like, you know, and I wonder if that was part of the conversation. If we take this out, it's going to feel fairly mundane down in that big low area, and it kind of serves as a really nice exclamation point in that, in the land of that hole sits on, you know, probably the most boring part of the ground.
Let me get your thoughts on two holes and then two greens. And then we'll let you go. 12 and 13. Every time I go there and I look at 12, part of it is that there's nothing behind there. They don't allow spectators behind it. So it really is like a stage. And it's, you know, for all intents and purposes, it almost kind of looks like an open field. And it's 150 yards, and they've been having to manipulate yardage it is what it is. Why is it so good?
It's the angle, right? It's the way the green sits. It appears from the tee that it's sitting directly across from you. But, you know, we all know that it's tilted in a way, the way it runs. It's just, you know, it's half a club wrong, and you're in trouble, right? And so I think from that standpoint, it's just whether he understood that, I think he did, to how... And Jim and I have implemented that on a lot of our designs on shortish par threes, you know, to say, listen, let's just change the, just so that the carry number is just enough that, okay, I'm safe if I go left. If I go right with that number, I'm done. Okay, so now what do I need to hit to go right, okay, to be safe going that way? And now if I pull it a little bit, I'm done. So it's one of those things that really throws you into a difficult situation, right? And it was interesting when they were talking about, you know, the left-handed versus right-handed players and how, you know, the carries a little, it just sets up better for a left-hander, because if you're going to pull it, you're going to go, you know, a little bit longer, and that's where you need it a little bit longer. If you're going to cut it, you're going to go a little bit shorter, and that's where it works out. But for the right-handed golfer, it's just the opposite, and that's why we see that happens so much. You get a little gust, you know, we all know that the golf gods play some tricks down in that corner. And I think so, the brilliance, the setup, I mean, again, the putting green itself isn't diabolical. I mean, you obviously have to pay attention because of the speeds, but it's just all about that angle and that tilt. And if you look at the bunkering behind the green, that's probably the one place on the property where we get some fraying. You know, you've got the sort of ivy or whatever's growing up on that hillside, ground cover coming down in. And I think that's a beautiful composition that obviously everyone's focused on Race Creek and the green and the bunker in front. But, you know, maybe this time when you're watching, you know, people are listening, when you're watching the 12th hole, take a look at the bunkering behind the green. It really is beautiful.
13, speaking of kind of diagonal, the tributary and the way that it is set up, you know, You look at what is theoretically a back pin, but it looks like it's more right because, again, you're having to cross more. There is more that you're challenging yourself from, and also the tilt of the land itself. Just walk us through your thoughts about that hole, which many could argue is the most famous hole in the world because of the gravity of what has transpired there through the generations.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those half par holes, and, you know, we've got another year now to look at with the new tee and see kind of what.
Yeah, last year wasn't fair. It was wet the whole week. It was not a fair examination.
So it'll be interesting to see this year how that works out. But I think it's brilliant. It's all about angles and slopes. It's everything we've talked about, and the precision required to hit these things and play different types of shots because of the ground. You know, the severe tilt of the fairway in that area, obviously the presence of Race Creek and how it meanders down the left and then crosses over to the right in front of the green. I mean, it is, it's just a bit. You know, you'd like to think that if you're ever given a piece of ground like that, you'd figure that out because it's just so good. And it's just, and as you said, the gravity of it, especially on Sunday, you know, you've got basically two really good chances to make birdie, possible eagle on 13 and 15. You've just come through the toughest stretch of the golf course. And now here you are with this sort of do or die type shot. And it's, you have to be precise. And the green itself requires that as well. I mean, you can miss in bad spots on that green, and three putting is really going to be not a happy result, but a realistic result if you get yourself out of position or if you miss up in the swale. So I think there's all kinds of outcomes there that weigh on the fact that there's the expectation that you're going to make four at the worst. And then you walk off of it making five, and now you're really upset, even though you just made par, you make six, God forbid, you know, now you're, so the swings that can happen there are also an incredible part of it. You know, a three jumpstarts somebody, puts them right back in contention. A five is a huge disappointment. So I think from those standpoints, the psychological aspect of that golf hole and where it's placed in the round of golf is perfect. And the golf hole itself is perfect.
Yeah, I'm telling you, and it's going to happen again this year. They use that, you know, kind of back right pin on Sunday, and naturally you're going to have a lot of balls that go past it on second shots. And the number of putts that I have seen in the 40 plus years I've been watching it, of guys thinking there's more pull left to that particular pin, and it's, for whatever reason, it's straighter from behind the hole, you know, 15, 18, 20 feet. And the number of guys who extend their hand, like, how did that go more? I mean, I just, again, there's so much there to examine. Let me get your thoughts on two greens before I let you go, because you already talked about 14, which is, to me, art. Three green. Thought about, I think, again, you have to go there, and you can't get close enough to see how treacherous, especially like front left. You got a short club in your hand, but nonetheless, just your thoughts about the third green to begin with.
Well, I think Jim and I paid it the ultimate compliment where we didn't copy it directly, but it inspired us greatly on PGA Frisco on the East Course. So in 27, you'll see, or 20 next year, you'll see the ladies tackle a hole very similar. I mean, the rest of the hole isn't exactly the same, but the green complex is very similar. In 27, you'll see the men tackle that as well. So it's obviously been hugely influential and impressive to Jim and I that we'd go to that length to try to replicate it to a certain degree. You're right. It's all about control into that pin, and the fact that some players lay up, some players bomb it. Standing down below that green, you can't believe how high above your head it is, number one, and how narrow that shelf is on the left to try to hit, whether you skip something up there, get it to stop, do you try and fly something up there? Just, I love watching players on you know, I think it's the shortest par four on the golf course, with the wheels just constantly spinning. They're turning as, what should we do? What should I hit? And then, you know, the right-hand side, the extension that goes back, there's so much cross slope from right to left that, you know, you see them play it up above and it spins down below. And then that's another putt they never seem to be able to read when they come back up. And God forbid you leave it up above, you know, and you've got that curl. I mean, the curling on that putt is amazing. And so, you know, a lot of the focus gets put on that left-hand shelf, and appropriately so, because of the tight place you're hitting into. But the cross slope on the right-hand side of that green causes the players fits as well. So when you get a hole of that length that asks a lot of questions off the tee, where do I want to put myself in order to go into that green? And then asks another really compelling question with, how do I get it into the proper section of that green? I think that's the best you can do with a short par four.
Hole number five, I recommend people, if you want to read a book about a great historical perspective on the Masters, David Owen's book, The Making of the Masters. And one of the things he points out was how arduous the process was to build that hole. And the road hole, There was certainly thoughts from Jones and McKenzie in terms of the way it was constructed and designed, But the green itself, again, similar to 14, you just go, oh my God, like look at what exists here. Your thoughts on the fifth green?
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, similar to 14, there's a lot of green that you're looking at that doesn't serve any purpose. It serves a huge purpose from the standpoint of rejecting shots and pulling them back off, but you never get a hole location on it. So you're standing there looking at this big false front and you're thinking, wow, that's a pretty good size green. And then you realize the part of the green that you actually have to hit to that a ball will stay up on the shelf that you need to. I'm always fascinated by that sort of left-hand shelf when they put the pins up there and you've got the bunker over the back, and just it's so tight. And with the additional length to the golf hole, and players, you know, steering clear of the bunker and down the left-hand side with a little bit longer club coming into there, you know, it all gets back to that level of precision. It's just, it's an incredibly difficult shot to hit. And I can only imagine the rewarding feeling of actually pulling it off. And then you got to get up there and hit putts that seem to, again, defy logic as to which way they break. You know, and it's always that green seems to provide an awful lot of head scratchers as well. When the guys are standing there and they hit a putt and they feel like they've hit a good one and it just doesn't quite turn the way that they think it should. But from a composition standpoint, again, it's I believe it's an understanding and appreciation of scale in what you're presenting to the golfer and the way they're looking at it from out in the fairway. And the relationship of that false front and the size of it in relation to the elevation change that it brings on, right? I mean, on the 17th, on the road hole on the old course, it's a fairly abrupt up onto the upper shelf that runs behind the road hole bunker. Here, it's got much more of a sort of a big, long flow to it. And I feel like the scale of this matches the elevation change really very, very nicely. It's not too abrupt, but it's abrupt enough that it's going to reject a shot, but it just feels more in concert. Whereas, you know, the road hole, that's just what was there, right? It wasn't like somebody created that shelf and said, okay, this is how we're going to divide and make the elevation change. Whereas McKenzie and Jones had to stand there and say, all right, listen, what is the relationship both in the depth of it and the height of it that we want to present to the golfer to create the effect of that false front. And as they did with the rest of the property, they just nailed it.
Listen, you're at work, you're in your office, you're awfully kind to take the time. I look forward to seeing you. Of all the people who will be on the grounds at Augusta National this year, who will be taking in a lot of golf shots, but actually he'll be looking beyond whoever's hitting the shot at something, some landform, it's you.
Yeah, well, it'll be me. I always enjoy it. It's fun. It's, you know, having grown up in the Northeast and living in the Northeast, it's the start of golf season.
Yes.
Right? It's spring. It's everything exciting about the game of golf, especially in this day and age. We get to actually sit back and talk about what we should really be talking about and focusing on, which is amazing architecture, amazing stage for the game of golf, and watching the best players in the world take it on.
Thanks as always.
Thanks, Gary. Always enjoy it. Be well.
Really appreciate Gil taking the time. I know that you appreciate all the things that he said. There's a lot of nuance to that. There's a lot of nerding out on land and landforms. But if you go to the Masters this year, think about some of the things that he said, in particular about 3 green and 5 green, the McKenzie bunker on 10, the 14th green. And I would tell you, I have favorite places on every single hole. And I highly recommend, like, go out at the turning point on 13 and look back at 12 green and look at 13 tee. And yes, take time to look at 14 green, but also stand up on the top of the hill on 6 and see the proximity of that to the 16th green, to the 7th tee, to the 13th green. The confluence of so many things there that you don't necessarily get if you're just watching it on television. And a lot of you know, maybe you haven't been there, but it is, it's really something to see. And most importantly, I appreciate all of you listening to my conversation with Gil. Masters Week is about upon us. The design preview We'll see you next time right here on Five Clubs.